The headlines. Russia warns it could target convoys of Western arms supplies destined for Ukraine. Moscow describes them as legitimate targets. German Chancellor and the French President call for an immediate ceasefire of the Ukraine conflict during a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And the Red Cross pleads the world not to forget the people of Yemen as the global attention shifts towards the conflict in Ukraine. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russian troops can target Western supplies of weapons in Ukraine. That's according to the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov. He says the orchestrated pumping of weapons is a dangerous move and turns these convoys into legitimate targets. The senior Russian diplomat says Moscow has already warned Washington and its allies about the consequences of the, quote, thoughtless transfer of weapons like portable air defense and anti-tank missile systems. He is critical of the U.S. not heeding Russia's warnings. The U.S., Canada, and several European countries, including Germany, have been sending weapons to Ukraine for months. The German Chancellor and the French President are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine. Olaf Scholz and Emmanuel Macron made the call during a phone conversation with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. A German government spokesperson says the conversation is part of the ongoing international efforts to end the conflict in Ukraine. Scholz had already spoken to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky about the situation. Officials from Kiev and Moscow have held several rounds of discussions since the beginning of the Russian offensive. After talks between the two countries' top diplomat on Thursday, the Ukrainian foreign minister said no progress was made on achieving a ceasefire in Ukraine. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes says meaningful West Russia talks and a willingness to reach a compromise could have averted the Ukraine conflict.
The clear picture is emerging, and it has been emerging for many years, and that is the only way to solve the tensions between Russia and the West would be by having talks and by having meaningful talks. But unfortunately, any meaningful talks have come too late. And you look at what Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz, they are sort of the kingpins in terms of the European Union structure, the main countries. But their efforts prior to the conflict failed. I mean, you remember the time when Olaf Scholz was standing at a press conference beside Vladimir Putin, and he talked about the fact that, you know, something along the lines that Putin won't be in power forever. And it's the type of thing that Angela Merkel never would have said. You know, Russia was talking about the fact that Ukraine, you know, was being used as a pawn by the West to basically try to provoke it and to try to interfere with its security. You have a situation where NATO was continuing to send troops and military hardware to its eastern flanks. And at the same time, these so-called diplomatic efforts were failing. Russia wanted, maybe that Russia was asking for too much, there's no doubt about that when you look at what the demands were to the United States. But I mean, what about compromise? What about meaningful compromise? You know, the situation is that NATO is expanding at all costs. Russia was trying to look after its legitimate, you know, security, regional security concerns. And as I said, maybe it was asking for too much, but maybe they could have met somewhere in the middle. But all of that now seems a little bit too late.
The latest update on the number of Ukrainian refugees. The UN says that nearly 2.6 million people have fled the conflict. The figure is over 90,000 higher than the last count on Friday. Several neighboring countries have, however, reported a drop of 10 to 20% in the number of arrivals on Friday. Poland is hosting over half the Ukrainian refugees, with 1.6 million people crossing into the country. The UN says that this has been the largest exodus of refugees in Europe since World War II. Up to 4 million people are estimated to leave Ukraine. The influx has made governments and volunteers struggle to find shelter for refugees. The greatest pressure is on big cities, where most of the refugees have headed for. Authorities in Crimea say the U.S. had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. According to the deputy chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Washington wanted to open the lab in the capital of Simferopol. George Muradov says the reunification of the peninsula with Russia in 2014 stopped the plan. Muradov, who is the permanent representative of the Republic of Crimea under the Russian president, says the documents discovered at that time at the former Soviet plate control station in Simferopol have exposed the plan. He He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in secret laboratories in the Ukrainian territory. His comments came only a few days after Moscow accused Washington of financially supporting a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens like the plague and anthrax. Saudi Arabia has announced mass execution of 81 people in one day on alleged terrorism-related offenses. The figure exceeds the total number of executions there in 2021 and marks the kingdom's highest number of recorded executions in one day. The convicts include members of the Ansarullah movement. They're accused of attempting to assassinate security officers, targeting police stations, plotting attacks on vital places, and smuggling weapons into the country. No court documents are available to verify the allegations. Saudi Arabia executed more than 2,000 people between 1985 and 2016. Rights groups have cited rampant cases of torture and unfair trials. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The International Committee of the Red Cross warns that the world must not forget Yemen and other war-torn countries as the conflict in Ukraine grabs everyone's attention. The head of the Red Cross delegation in Yemen, Katharina Ritz, said that the Ukraine must be added to all the crises currently taking place, but the focus should or must not shift to the European country. She said that the world should not lose sight of the plight of those living through the years-long war in Yemen. Ritz added that people's duty is to equally help everyone in need. Earlier, the UN's Children's Fund also warned of the situation in Yemen. UNICEF said that over 10,000 minors have so far been killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. 47 of the cases were recorded in the first 2 months of 2022 alone. Masoud Shajar is the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who joins us from London. We also have Brian Terrell, who's a political commentator and peace activist, joining us from Molloy in Iowa. Welcome to you both. Masoud Shajar, what's happening in Ukraine in terms of civilian casualties obviously is something that is sad, to say the least. But when you have such massive media coverage, it makes you wonder how it is that a war that is claimed, I'm not too sure, maybe 100 times more civilian deaths, does not get even close to that coverage. So there's a double standard there in the way that this is being covered in terms of the tally of deaths at a minimum.
It's absolutely shocking. It goes without saying that we are compassionate towards anyone who is in a war zone and is, as a civilian, are suffering. But, you know, it's so shocking to see that there is complete undermining the values based on people. When we look at what is happening in Yemen, what is happening in Libya, in Syria, what has happened in Iraq, what has happened in Afghanistan, millions and millions of people have been killed and no compassion to them whatsoever. And it's always been explained away as, look, this is a necessary evil. We have to implement democracy, human right of the people. We are there to protect them. And then they kill them. They kill them in the fields. They kill them everywhere. And now it seems that, completely there is a Alice in Wonderland sort of situation that we are seeing completely different standards. And they have no way of explaining this now, except based on racism, to say that these are blue eyes, blonde hairs, and therefore we need to look after them. I mean, even the train companies, which were instrumental in refugees dying because they couldn't get on the track or they died trying to get onto the train, not giving free tickets to Ukrainians to actually come to Britain or travel around Europe. It's outrageous. It really is outrageous. And I think it really shows the principles behind colonialism, the principles behind the US hegemony. They're not even ashamed of being so double standard and so racist and so aggressive you know, what does the Palestinians or Yemenis think watching what is happening today in Western Europe, who claims to be the flag bearers of human rights and justice and democracy?
Well, Brian Terrell, the Ukrainian President Zelensky has said that, you know, we want to have talks, and has asked the U.S., you know, can you be a little bit more proactive in helping us to achieve talks, to get somewhere when it comes to this? Well, in that respect, don't you think maybe that this should be a wake-up call for the U.S., perhaps, and other countries that are involved in different conflicts to try to put that motion forward for those conflicts as well, whether it's Yemen, whether it's the Palestinian cause, whether it's in Libya, wherever else that there are conflicts? I'm guessing this would be a good starting point.
Yes, it would be. But I'm afraid what we're seeing is an influx of weapons made by American and European weapons manufacturers going into Ukraine, and only exacerbating the problem. Looking at Yemen, just over a year ago, his very first address on foreign policy as President of the United States, Joe Biden joined the world in condemning the war and the blockade of Yemen as a humanitarian disaster, and he said this has to stop, and there will be no more support for the Saudi attack on Yemen. And a few months later, very quietly, a sale of missiles from made by Raytheon was approved to Saudi Arabia. I have to applaud the ICRC saying that we have to add the horrible things going on in Ukraine have to be added. Of course they do. The concern of the world has to be there. But how can we add it to all the others? And I hate to start listing them because you leave somebody out and that's horrible. You know, Haiti, Congo, Gaza, Honduras, the border, the people who are dying in the desert of the United States and Mexico, you know, refugees, and the refugees who are dying trying to cross the Mediterranean. It's impossible, but what's not impossible is to stop these at their core, at their cause. Right. The situation in Ukraine didn't have to happen. It's the encroachment of NATO that made this back in the 1990s. Everybody said, everyone, there's total agreement, including Joe Biden, the senator then, that we're headed for trouble if NATO expands. We have to disarm, and we have to distribute the goods of the earth more fairly.
Well, let's take a quick time out here and listen to some social media posts on this matter, and we'll come right back to you. First post today, for some reason, I feel hopeful. Is there a chance that the visible war in Ukraine will make the invisible wars in Yemen, Palestine, and other places visible? Next, what is happening in Ukraine is appalling. We should be responding, but also Syria is appalling. Yemen is appalling. Palestine is appalling. We need the same outpouring of support for these conflicts. Suffering does not know color, but our humanitarian response sure does. Our next post, war is painful, devastating, whether in Yemen, Palestine, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and the Ukraine, among others, whether it is waged with huge tanks or low-intensity wars. What's painful, though, is that some wars get our attention, others not. Why has the U.S. never faced any sanctions when they invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and bombarded Yemen, Syria, and others? Isn't the same thing that Putin is doing with Ukraine now? Why does the world ignore one conflict? In the end, on both sides, innocent people are dying. And our final social media post. In less than a month of war in Ukraine, the entire body of the Western media has been shaken. While such events are taking place in Yemen for 7 years, massacre, children, lack of food and medicine, and more than 4 million displaced people, is humanity dead? Okay, some of the social media posts there. it seems like we jumped the gun, Master Shajar, because many of those posts actually covered what we just spoke about. But how about talking about how these wars get initiated? The country that's most involved, and I'm not trying to pick on this country, but stats speak for themselves, is that the U.S. has been involved in more wars and initiated more wars than any other country. Why, in particular, is the U.S. involved in this activity, this type of activity, do you think?
Well, U.S. hegemony, and to preserve that and exceptionalism for U.S., it needs to have its armed forces to go around kicking people around and sort of forcing them into submission to the U.S. Supremacy. That is one issue. The other issue is that the U.S. Sort of does extremely well in selling arms and actually sort of improving its economy. So wars are means good things for United States. Ever since the Second World War, U.S. have made huge profits from the sale of arms, and that profit goes to the 1%, not the ordinary people. So ordinary people won't benefit, but indeed those in power and those with the majority of influence do benefit. And the only way to stop this is to sort of put forward the concept that every human being is matters, and security for everyone is equally matters. And you know, this law of jungle, which has been implemented by U.S. under the pretense of democracy, human right, and justice, needs to stop. And if it doesn't, it will destroy us.
Thank you so much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, and Massoud Shajar, a pleasure, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the UK. As the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs, and the production of fertilizer. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sarah Butler. The piece is titled, UK Farmers Call for Urgent Action to Prevent Soaring Food Prices. In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the United Kingdom as the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs, and the production of fertilizer. The National Farmers Union, NFU, has written to the government warning of multiple compounding factors that have profound implications and risks for our food security, including further pressure on labor costs as Ukrainian workers have made up about 60% of workers taking up seasonal worker visas to pick and pack produce since the UK left the European Union. It has called for a review of the immigration system to help bring in 10,000 more seasonal workers and for urgent action to prioritize gas for food production and make it easier to use organic fertilizers and manure as an alternative to those produced using fossil fuels. Minette Batters, the president of the National Farmers Union, the NFU, said the conflict in Ukraine had focused attention on the importance and fragility of food security, both here at home and abroad. There are some clear short and long-term actions that government can take to maintain confidence and stability across the UK's food-producing businesses, she said. Minette Batters added, We have shared these with the government and we want to stress that we stand ready to take these forward together in order to navigate the extreme volatility we see today and expect to grow in the coming months. While Britain does not import much wheat directly from Ukraine, the country plays a significant part in European food production, and the conflict in Ukraine has forced up food prices across the board. The country also accounts for about 45% of rapeseed, which is imported to the United Kingdom and used to make cooking oil, more than a fifth of maize imports, which are used for animal feed and biofuels, while 80% of sunflower oil comes from the Black Sea region and has been interrupted by the conflict in Ukraine, according to analysts at the UK's Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. The National Farmers Union call for action comes as Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, said it was now running at only half its normal capacity after shutting down two plants in Italy and France this week because of the rising price of gas, a key input to the production process. Gas prices have risen amid the risk of a cutoff in supply from Russia, which produces about 40% of the gas used in Europe. Svein Tore Holsether, the chief executive of Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, warned that further closures could be on the cards if gas prices continue to rise. As well as potentially affecting the production of fertilizer by the autumn, it could also hit supplies of carbon dioxide, a byproduct of the production process which is used in animal slaughter and food packaging. Things are changing day by day. We have a lot of uncertainty at the moment, and it is hard to predict going forward, but there is real risk that carbon dioxide will be impacted as a result of this. Meanwhile, pig farmers warned that the industry faced collapse as the soaring grain price only added to existing cost prices on feed and from labor shortages. The situation is now beyond desperate and there is no light at the end of the tunnel, said Rob Mutimer, chair of the National Pig Association in Britain. The group has written to retailers asking for an increase in payments to more than £2 per kilogram, more than 50%, or about 70 pence more than is currently being paid. Without the extra payment, the National Pig Association said more farmers would quit the industry, which has suffered months of difficulties. We're staring down the barrel of a total collapse of the British pig industry, which is not only a tragedy for the producers themselves, but will leave UK consumers short of one of their favourite and most versatile meats, he said. The wheat price now stands in the region of £300 a tonne, compared with about £215 a tonne just a few days ago. Poultry and pork producers are likely to be first to be affected by the rising grain prices, as bakeries and other producers using flour generally pay for their supplies well in advance. The next few weeks are critical for sowing wheat and other crops in Ukraine, which is currently involved in a conflict. Dr. John Rich, the chair of the MHP, one of the country's biggest grain producers, says, "If this continues, of course, our ability to sow rapidly diminishes, particularly if the conflict in Ukraine is prolonged." He said this could lead to complete failure of Ukraine to produce any grain. "The consequences are unimaginable as far as Ukraine is concerned," he said. "For the wider world, it's simple. The price of wheat will continue to rise. The price of corn and other commodities will also rise significantly. And you have spiraling inflation at a time when we already had problems with the global supply chain because of the COVID pandemic," he added.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Early January, Ghanaians were pleasantly surprised to see the country's Speaker of Parliament, Alban Begbin, dressed in traditional clothing instead of a ceremonial outfit with colonial links. He addressed Parliament on the reason for adapting Ghana's traditional attire.
"We must create a unique set of values and norms that will give a unique character to our parliament to set it apart from the colonial legacies of the British system."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on a very commendable decision by the Speaker of Ghana's Parliament to dump decades-old cloak of the Speaker for traditional Ghanaian attire. This move is seen as a step towards the revival of the country's rich culture. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the decision by Twitter to disable accounts of African activists opposed to United States imperialism. We are asking, why are the US-based social media giants intent on muzzling the voices of freedom in Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ghana, back to the roots. The Speaker of the Parliament in Ghana, Alban Babin, fulfilled his promise of limiting the wearing of Western suits and gowns during sitting in the House. The Speaker ditched his ceremonial outfit for traditional attire for sitting in the House on January 25, 2022. He wore a traditional outfit with kente cloth and a crown worn by chiefs during ceremonies. The kente fabric comes originally from Ghana centuries ago and is one of the best known of all African textiles. The kente cloth subsequently became a symbol of Pan-African identity and a symbol of black pride.
Now, prior to wearing kente during his official parliamentary duties, Begbin urged members of parliament to promote locally made traditional outfits and market Ghanaian culture instead of wearing Western attire.
You will not be seeing me often again with that dress code, a suit, and that aristocratic cloak or gown. You may be seeing me more with traditional dresses. I may use that only for ceremonial occasions, which is what is in the literature of Ghana concerning that cloak and gown. It's for only ceremonial occasions. So those who know former speakers, you see former speaker Asedu wearing a kente and a shirt. And that is what is the portrait we have today. And so we have to change all that. Well, we have to provide the market for our produce.
Now, for more on the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to adopt the country's traditional clothing, we contacted Jonathan Ofei Anso, Ghanaian journalist and commentator. He's also the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's your initial reaction to the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to dump decades-old colonial cloak for the country's traditional clothing?
Well, I do applaud him, you know, for the step he's taken, because we are Ghanaians, and we have our traditions, we have our customs, we have our costumes. We've been independent for 65 years. So I see no reason why, you know, the parliamentary speaker should be donned in the colonial regalia with the wig. Look, even considering the weather, though, the parliament is fully air-conditioned. Still, it does not speak well, you know, of our culture. For our culture, you know, we have cultures, we have our own costumes. So I believe that the step he's taken, you know, should be applauded.
Ghanaians were clearly delighted by their parliament speaker for adopting the country's traditional attire. Many Ghanaians say the speaker showed the way in promoting the Ghana brand, and he urged the Chief Justice to emulate the speaker in ensuring that lawyers and judges are also permitted to dress in local fabrics in court. Can we say there is some sort of revival in the country and people are tired of colonial relics and want to return to their roots?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, judging by the reaction, you know, from Ghanaians, you know, generally within the country, I think, look, it shows how proud Ghanaians are of their heritage. Though I must say that we've been influenced a lot by Western cultural influences. But look, these days, when I was growing up, you know, in my teens, whatever, we all used to listen to soul music, reggae, you know, so on and so forth. But these days, when I go to Ghana, everywhere you go, especially the youth, you know, they all listen to Ghanaian music. Everywhere you go, it's Ghanaian music, Ghanaian music. So that should tell you that Ghanaians, you know, are at least the current youth, you know, the youth of today, the Ghanaian youth of today, appreciate more, you know, their culture than any Western influences.
The Ghanaian government has introduced the use of locally made Ankara fabrics as school uniforms in order to promote African prints.
The Speaker of Ghana's Parliament says his decision to adopt the kente traditional attire goes in line with the aspirations of the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah.
That this decision accords with some of the propositions of the first president of Ghana, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, and the other founding members of the Parliament of the First Republic. The government dress code of members of the National Assembly of Independent Ghana was native costume.
Now, what impact will the move to adapt African fabrics have on the youth in Ghana?
It's going to have a very, very positive impact. I recall about 20 or so years ago, the government did not rule, but set this trend of that every Friday, public servants should not go to work in Western attire. So these days, you go to Ghana, you go to the ministries, offices, whatever, you see men and women wearing traditional garments. The men usually wear shirts made from Ghanaian cotton prints.
The government of Ghana is also involved in efforts to promote local products and boost employment. The Made in Ghana initiative was developed by the Ministry of Trade and Industry to promote products made in this West African country. In his introductory remarks after deciding to wear the traditional attire, this is what Ghana's president said on the need to promote products made in the country.
This is the Parliament of Ghana. It's a unique Made in Ghana product. And we must showcase and market it to the world as a brand.
Can the move to traditional attire be replicated in other sectors to attain self-sufficiency and disentangle the country from dependency and neo-colonialism?
It's a mindset that not only Ghanaians, Africans in general, have this mindset that anything coming from abroad is better than what, you know, is being produced locally. Like, you take a vehicle, you take a computer, you take a mobile phone, I mean, name it. Even close, I mean, they think, Africans think that whatever is manufactured abroad in Europe, America, China, Asia is much better than what is produced locally. So it's a trend that, a mindset, but it will take a long time for this mindset to change. So what the government is doing now is a step in the right direction, but it's they are taking the baby steps. Okay, I mean, the school children wearing uniforms made from our own local fabrics, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. So by the time they grow to be adults, that culture will be ingrained, will be inculcated in them to move forward. So I believe that, look, it's a mindset. A mindset, it takes a long to change one's mindset. But I believe that Ghana and Africa will get there.
In Africa, dress provides a powerful tool to challenge neo-colonialism and is also considered an effective method of cultural expression and resistance. Now, additionally, a person's dress code can reveal dimensions of political and social transformations that cannot be discerned through verbal and written articulations. There is a movement now to drop colonial attire in African parliaments and judicial organs. Now, most countries in Africa still use clothing linked to cultural colonialism. Isn't it about time that African countries take serious measures to revive their cultural identity?
Well, you take Moscow, look, go to Nigeria and go to the Sahelian countries, you know, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea, Senegal, Gambia. Most of them wear the bubu, you know, the African bubu, you know. And you take the armed services, like they say, the police, the army, they wear uniforms, okay? I mean, it is convenient. I mean, a policeman cannot wear the traditional African garment. In Ghana, our very traditional, the men wear a cloth wrapped over the shoulder. A policeman cannot use that garment, neither can a soldier. So that the uniform used by the security services, the army, the police, and so on and so forth, I think it's okay. But look, it will take a long time. We need to start from somewhere. Recently, the African Union officially adopted Swahili, the Swahili language, as an official working language for the EU. That is one step. So look, if you learn, you know your language, the more you know your language, the more you know your culture. So it will take some time, but I believe that eventually Africa will get there.
Thank you very much, Ofei Ansah, for your time and insight. Indeed, Africa is on the right path towards cultural revival. Now, we now take a short break, and our next subject will be on the crackdown launched by Twitter against African activists opposed to imperialism and neocolonialism. So stay with us.
Twitter crackdown on African activists.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States social media giant Twitter has disabled the accounts of several Ethiopians and Eritreans and their related groups without justification. Now, the accounts had recently helped promote the No More and Hands Off hashtags in the campaign against illegal intervention by the U.S. in the internal affairs of the two countries and other parts of Africa.
Amongst the disabled accounts was Horn of Africa Hub, a page started in October 2021 with over 18.8 thousand followers. This page described itself as combating false, deadly narratives about the Horn of Africa, including in Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and beyond.
Now, apart from the activities on Twitter, activists have also organized peaceful protests across the world to popularize the No More and Hands Off hashtags. There is one such protest in South Africa.
This thing's happened the past 3 years, you know. We've been trying to solve out the things in back home, but still he's trying. Our Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy, he's trying himself. But the thing is, the other opponent party, the TPLF, they don't want the leadership that he's running. And then they get support from U.S., actually. They get truly support from U.S. because the overseas news, the parties which is passing through CNN, BBC, the fake news that they produce for us.
Now, for more on the Twitter crackdown on online movements opposed to U.S. imperialism and neocolonialism, we contacted Hermela Ergawi, an Ethiopian-American journalist. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we have seen lies on mainstream media and crackdowns on the social media. What's your take on the crackdown by the social media giants against online activists?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that I was for a long time a part of the mainstream media. I worked for the CBS affiliate in LA, Al Jazeera America, which is pretty mainstream when it was launched here, as well as other local affiliates. So I'm very familiar with what the standards of mainstream media are supposed to be. And so I was really disappointed to find out that a lot of the reporting in the usual mainstream outlets like CNN, New York Times, was over time became very clear that it was not objective, that it was telling only this one-sided story, very much became propaganda. And so that's what inspired me to sort of move into this space and be a part of the conversation. And social media is the only way to really push back when you are reaching out to CNN and reaching out to outlets and saying, hey, this part of the story you guys are not covering over the course of months, then the only outlet you really have is social media. So we started the hashtag No More campaign to push back against a lot of the false narratives that were taking hold in the mainstream outlets.
Hashtag No More movement started in Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa and then quickly spread out to other regions in Africa and beyond around the world and became a symbol of resistance against imperialism. In as far as Norway, Ethiopians and other diaspora Africans gathered to express their opposition to the US meddling in Africa.
TPLF is a terrorist organization. TPLF is a Trojan horse of United States. USA, learn from your mistakes. No to US invasion. No to US invasion in Ethiopia. No to US invasion in Eritrea. We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia.
We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
with Eritrea. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ms. Aregawi, can you elaborate more on what the No More and Hands Off hashtags are all about?
So hashtag No More was created in response to what was essentially government propaganda, U.S. government propaganda that was being told through mainstream media outlets about the conflict in Ethiopia. The mainstream narrative was that the Ethiopian government was trying to genocide the people of Tigray. Tigray is a region with ethnic Tigrayans, or largely ethnic Tigrayans, which make up maybe about 5% of the population. Both of my parents are from there, so I guess you would say I'm ethnically Tigrayan. So there is no part of me that wants to support a genocide against people of my ethnicity, and there isn't evidence to back that.
Twitter has taken down thousands of accounts in vast sweeps that sometimes claim to be targeting state-directed disinformation operations, but actually the objective is to clamp down on anti-US messages. Why are Western powers, especially the US, muzzling free African voices, especially Ethiopians, in social media platforms who are opposed to the TPLF rebels?
I really think the foreign policy right now is so extremely misguided. I don't think that this helps the US at all. Honestly, the communities in the diaspora are trying to understand why is the US betting on this group that they cannot rely on. This group cannot even be relied on by their own people in the Tigray region, who are essentially at this point held hostage, right? So it's really confusing because it doesn't seem productive, but the US has taken the stance anyway.
The anti-war No More was a trending hashtag for weeks until Twitter blocked it. Now, despite the censorship by Twitter, this African campaign continues on social media platforms. Activists say that apart from Ethiopia, this campaign is also targeting US interference in other African countries.
Ethiopians can govern their own affair. The United States should not be interfering in this, and that is why we are here. We are here to say no more Afghanistan, no more Syria in Ethiopia. Ethiopia can decide its own fate. And the interference that we see from Western countries is totally uncalled for. It's not necessary, and it should stop.
Over 100 million people are supporting the current government, and here in diaspora have a high support of what's going on in Ethiopia. So we're trying to tell the Biden administration, don't interfere. Ethiopia is a sovereign nation. We can make decisions and should not be supporting the terrorist group who wants to come back to power again by force.
Now, Ms. Aregawi, do you think the US and other Western powers will succeed in silencing the voices of Africans who say no more to imperialism and neocolonialism?
I do not think they will be successful in silencing the people that are rallying around No More. This is something that's been decades in the making. The frustration that people have didn't just pop up last year. This is something really deep that the people know really well. And so it's a matter of how the U.S. will respond. So will they evolve? Will foreign policy here in the U.S. evolve in how it's been dealing with the Horn of Africa and other parts of Africa? Or is it just going to stay down this road, destroy the relationships with those countries, and essentially push them in a different direction in terms of geopolitics and who they choose to ally with? And you do see that. There's some support from Russia and China in the Horn of Africa. And part of that is they, you know, the U.S. has just essentially pushed the people of that country in that direction because they continue to tell the propaganda of the armed terrorist group that has waged a war on the people of Ethiopia. So all these different groups can't be silent.
Twitter is now facing accusations of pursuing a destabilization policy in Africa. The Nigerian says the U.S. technology company is employing double standards and supporting the secessionists in the West African country.
U.S. social media giants have come under fire over misuse of their platforms to spread hate and incitement in conflict areas in Africa and elsewhere. Now, what's your take on that?
You know, like everything else, if you don't evolve, you die. So there are more than 1.3 billion people in Africa. Many of them are young. Over the course of the next decade or two, many of them are going to be using social media platforms. So if Twitter and Facebook does not become more culturally competent and hire people from the diaspora in different regions to get a better understanding of what is going on in those countries, then they will either intentionally or unintentionally be backing groups that are essentially behind violent elements in different countries. So in the beginning, I thought it was a context issue, even with the mainstream media. And then over time, when they had data that was countering what they were alleging and chose to ignore it, then it became clear that this was intentional.
Thank you very much, Ms. Haramela Aregawi, for your incisive analysis. Unfortunately, our time is up for today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we shall keep our eyes on the anti-imperialist movement in Africa here at Africa Today. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat Obad 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/ www.afrikatoday.org/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.